Well, I'm open-minded to anything that solves the climate challenge, and you know, I'm willing to fund very high-risk stuff. Even the money that I have, if it was all applied in this direction, you know, I put in $2 billion so far, I'll put in another $2 billion over the next 5 years, that's not enough to solve it. The role of high-risk investing and philanthropy is to start things out, but it's really government policy has to carry this one.
More than 25 years after Bill Gates' first book, The Road Ahead, foretold the impact of personal computers and digital technology on our lives, the Microsoft co-founder is back with his third book, this time with a warning and a call to action for the world. In How to Avoid a Climate Disaster, due out Tuesday, Bill Gates presents an ambitious but achievable plan for saving the planet, including scientific and technological breakthroughs and unprecedented efforts on a global scale. On this special episode of the GeekWire podcast, Gates speaks with GeekWire reporter Lisa Stifler about the book, his reasons for focusing on the climate, the road ahead for the planet, and even the potential for collaborating with Amazon founder Jeff Bezos on the issue.
So throughout the book, you say that you are optimistic that humanity is up to the challenge posed by climate change. And when I read the book, I'm a little bit terrified by what we need to accomplish. However, you are someone who has set and achieved really ambitious goals, a computer on every desk, making huge dents in global disease. And I wonder, why did you write this book? And does this perspective help you make it so you are the right person to write that book?
Well, I admit that this is a huge problem, and it'll be tougher than anything humanity's ever done. And only by staying sort of constant in working on this over the next 30 years do we have a chance to do it. And having some people who think it's easy will be an impediment. Having people who think that it's not important will be an impediment. And you know, innovation is so unpredictable that we have to pursue many paths, and so that our chance of succeeding in each of the areas of emissions is very, very high. I have seen since 2015, when we started Breakthrough Energy Ventures, that we found, in that case, over 40 companies for the first fund, and we just, you know, it was surprisingly easy to raise money for the second fund, because most people stayed in and we had new people joining. And so that part, you know, has gone better than I expected. There are particularly innovations like, you know, artificial meat that if you'd asked me 5 years ago, I wouldn't think would be that far along. But even so, yes, there are days where it feels like focusing on something that requires global cooperation, changing the regulations of industries that are very critical, but most people just take for granted, things like electricity reliability or, you know, steel or cement. You know, it can appear quite daunting. So unless it's a priority, and in the U.S. that means a priority for both political parties, then you can be very worried that we're not going to achieve it.
Yeah, and you know, looking out, you know, a decade from now, you know, there are a lot of goals that are set for 2030. Where do you have the biggest hope for advances in innovation, policy, and markets? Kind of the three things that you say really need to come together to make movement in a decade. Where do you hope there'll be some progress?
Well, we can take all the areas of emissions and sort them by the scale of their green premium. You know, the absolute green premium, the percentage green premium. And what you see there is that there are some things like electric heat pumps, passenger cars, and some degree of power generation, electricity generation, that we have modest green premiums right now. And so we should take these 10 years and drive the scale of those things. You know, we may need some tax credits, some policies to help those. Those are the easiest, even though they're not easy. Then we have things where the green premium is much higher, like cement, where there really isn't any scale of activity to make green cement. You know, you can think of paying direct air capture, but that currently costs over $400 a ton. And so if you did it that way, the green premium would be absolutely gigantic for that, unaffordable. And so even rich countries are going to do it, not to mention middle-income countries like India, who even by 2050 will say to us, well, why, since we've emitted per capita so little and since we're still trying to buy basic shelter and air conditioning and lighting at night for our population, while you have houses 10 times the size that we have, you know, why shouldn't you subsidize whatever green premium remains if you really want us to make this change? And, you know, unless that's gone down over 95%, you know, it would dwarf, you know, all the foreign aid that's ever been given. And so it's unlikely to happen. So the U.S. isn't just about its emissions, it's about its innovation power to help the entire world. So some of the short-term goals, stating them in terms of this country's doing well, this country's not, that's fine. But those metrics don't really capture the hard parts, because everyone makes steel and cement, you know, basically the same way. And there's no one who's achieving their short-term goals by working on those areas in any meaningful degree. So it's not a path to zero just to take the things that we're able to deploy right now because they have modest green premiums. That alone doesn't get you there. So by 2030, you have to see incredible advances at bringing the green premium down. You know, let's say by then, hopefully it's down by, you know, at least 80%. And you have to see the continued deployment and the idea of the world coming together to in common see this is a super, super important effort.
You've had a lot of success in technology and are bullish on what technology can achieve. But now that you've had some time working in the climate space and you've dug into what these green premiums look like, you know, and the challenges with nuclear power and batteries, has this tempered your belief in the power of innovation?
Well, certainly, if you just look at what's happened in the chip and software and internet area, if you think anything like that can help happen in the physical economy, that would confuse you. The type of speed of improvement and cost reduction, there's no other domain like it. In fact, even in medicine that moves way more slowly than the digital world, even there, you know, in 10 years' time, you can do some very dramatic things. And, you know, that's a very hopeful space. But now we're talking about a part of the economy that's physically the largest, very little R&D, you know, very little change over the last few decades. And yet we're saying, you know, in 30 years, we're going to change it very, very dramatically. So it's certainly way harder than the advances that have taken place in other areas. I do think that the template of accelerating innovation by finding smart people and having risk capital and funding basic R&D and creating market-based price signals, I think those apply very much. And so, you know, I've had to learn about these new areas, reading a lot of books and meeting a lot of experts. But yes, my sense of how you drive innovation is part of what I'm bringing to this, suggesting that we can have a plan, you know, to go along with the goal and the energy that the advocates are putting out.
Well, and I wonder, you know, you talk about sort of how you've been learning and progressing in this area, and clearly your work here is going to build on what you accomplished at Microsoft and what you've accomplished with your foundation. And I have to wonder if from those experiences, there have been any particular missteps or evolution in your thinking that you are now having that awareness that you're bringing to this work. I mean, this is probably the hardest thing you've tackled, perhaps. And so what lessons learned are you applying from Microsoft and the foundation?
Well, the foundation in its early days saw its role as almost entirely on the innovation piece, that is, creation of new vaccines. The actual effort to buy and deliver them, to get the coverage levels up, you know, which is on the ground and sort of country by country delivery systems where you have to hire and pay and you know, have data that tells you whether things are going well. That we thought, you know, others would take the lead, but in fact, we found it that there were actually some innovations that were being used in rich and middle-income countries, like the rotavirus vaccine, that clearly there was no innovation problem. There was a volume and pricing problem, but also a, you know, convincing countries to adopt and making that super easy for them, and then, you know, not only adopt it, but to get their coverage of their kids up closer to 100%. So, you know, partnerships with the private sector, partnerships with governments, you know, the challenges of working in countries where the government's capacity to do things is very limited. You know, we've been on a learning curve, and, you know, that foundation work, you know, even as I'm doing all this climate thing, that's going to remain the by far the primary source of my philanthropic dollars are what's going through the foundation.
Coming up, the role of technology and hints of a collaboration between Gates and Jeff Bezos. We will be right back with more of Bill Gates speaking with GeekWire reporter Lisa Stifler about his new book, How to Avoid a Climate Disaster.
Technology moves fast. I need to move faster. WGU's competency-based education puts me in control of how fast I move through my IT degree program. I can accelerate my program by applying what I already know to my courses and focusing on the things I need to learn. Earn a respected accredited degree that propels your career in the IT field. Learn more at wgu.edu/IT certs included.
You talk about your pathway to getting to these climate issues is coming through your understanding of what needs to happen in low-income countries and their need to electrify, and kind of merging that with your recognition that if climate change isn't slowed down and addressed, that the good work that you're doing in global health is really undone by that. So how do you, in your mind, how do you rationalize spending more of your resources and energy in global health when everything is kind of, the underlining of everything is really climate change?
Well, the year 2000 saw over 10 million children die below the age of five. And today, with the great work that we've done with our partners, including creating things like Global Fund and Gavi, that's under 5 million a year. And, you know, we have a path to get it down from that 5 million to 2.5 million. So we're driving for health justice, where a child in the world has, you know, a 5% chance of dying before they see their fifth birthday. And we still have places, even without war, that are, it's 15 to 20%. That's where we're expert. You know, our malaria team, our vaccine factory team, and that's where we're going to stay committed. And the returns on that, the impact of that is phenomenal. It also happens that as kids grow up more healthily, their parents choose to have less kids. And so between improving health and getting voluntary family planning tools out there, there is a connection with climate. Also, our foundation, because of our agriculture work, is the biggest funder of climate adaptation. And that involves, in many cases, giving better seeds to these subsistence farmers so they can deal with the kind of drought and floods and higher temperature. You know, the climate makes a lot of crops way less productive and increases the number of years you have a crop failure from about 1 in 10 right now to 1 in 4, even 1 in 3. So that, you know, that adaptation work where I chaired the commission with a number of people and really tried to bring more attention to adaptation, you know, because we're not going to get away with 0 degrees increase. And, you know, these equatorial subsistence farmers are suffering the most. And that's most of the poor people in the world. So, you know, the foundation through its health and reproductive health and agriculture work, you know, it's helping with climate, but that's not the primary lens that foundation money is spent on. It's spent on saving lives, which, you know, is still, I think, a super, super important thing. They, you know, the foundation actually can fund the creation of a new vaccine. We're the biggest funders in all the diseases we work on except HIV, which is the one where the U.S. government spends more than we do, and then it's a gigantic drop to number three. In the case of climate change, you know, even the money that I have, if it was all applied in this direction, you know, I put in $2 billion so far, I'll put in another $2 billion over the next 5 years, that's not enough to solve it. The role of high-risk investing and philanthropy in creating programs like Fellows and Ventures and Catalyst, the role of philanthropy is to start things out, but it's really government policy has to carry this one. The energy market is a $5 trillion a year market. You know, for example, for nuclear fission, the U.S. government gave TerraPower an award, you know, where I agreed to fund half of the demo plant with private sector money and the government's funding the other half. You know, that will be an amazing tool if that all goes well and we can get the public acceptance. That will give you the reliability of power sources even when the weather is shutting down the intermittent sources of solar and wind. So it's really governments that need to take on climate change as a goal. No one can do it without all the rich world governments being part of it.
Well, and I'd love to talk a little more about TerraPower, kind of going down into the details a little bit. In that 2010 TED Talk, you talked about where you would hope to be and kind of the promise it held. Has that effort progressed as you have hoped? And where do you think it'll be in another 5 or 10 years?
Yeah, TerraPower's initial strategy was a plant site in China that we had a joint venture, and we had the Chinese government, U.S. governments had signed lots of agreements that this was going to be a joint thing, that, you know, making sure it was safe and economic and it achieved climate goals. Both governments shared that. As the government relationships deteriorated a little over 2 years ago, the U.S. government canceled that cooperation. And so TerraPower, for a period there, was basically shut down, and it wasn't clear what could happen. The Congress created a program, the Advanced Reactor Demonstration Program, and TerraPower competed in that and won a large award for the $4 billion demo plant. And so, you know, over the next 5 years, that'll get built, and it'll show people the economics and the safety. And, you know, it's the only from scratch reactor design that's been done going back to the 1950s, where we can use digital tools to simulate any problem and really optimize all these components. Because nuclear power, despite all the waste and safety and proliferation concerns, the main reason it's failing right now is that the reactors have gotten so costly to build. They're just not competitive, particularly in a place where natural gas is so incredibly inexpensive.
I thought it was interesting reading about the TerraPower work and thinking about Hanford in our backyard and sort of this area being a place where that technology has such important origins. That's more of a musing than a question, but I wanted to ask a little bit. You're looking at places where you've been investing and involved with climate, nuclear power with the meat substitutes. They're clearly super important, but a little bit more on the fringe, a little bit controversial. Do you see yourself kind of looking for those sorts of endeavors, and where else might you go that's kind of more in the outlying areas of innovation, perhaps? Kind of going forward on climate?
Well, I'm open-minded to anything that solves the climate challenge. And, you know, I'm willing to fund very high-risk stuff. I've got an amazing technical team at Breakthrough Energy Ventures that a lot of ideas come in, many of which, you know, don't look that strong. But we, you know, found over 40 companies to finance in that first fund. That's better than I expected. The list of potential investments for the second fund that just got announced a few weeks ago, it's very large, and the quality of those looks to be every bit as good as what we had in the first fund. And so I was very worried when I made the commitment in 2015 as part of the Paris talks, where countries agreed to double their energy R&D budgets, that, you know, my part of the deal, which was creating something that was not typical venture, but something tuned and 100% focused on climate change with a deep management team and a very deep science team, far, far more than any venture firm ever would put into their science capabilities, and yet, you know, only focused on companies that can have a dramatic impact on climate change. So it's a very novel construct. And, you know, partly because it's gone so well, that's why I'm adding at an earlier stage a thing called Fellows, where we finance, give gifts to people before they're ready for seed funding. And then this thing called Catalyst, which is about the demand for innovation, not just the supply of innovation, which will buy things that have high green premiums, but therefore create a market and start it down the learning curve where, you know, we hope to recreate for all these product areas what happened with wind and solar and lithium-ion batteries for passenger cars.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. That the evolution of breakthrough energy kind of snuck up on me, and some of your staff shared today information about Energy Catalyst, about the policy and advocacy piece. So it really rounds out what you're doing. And I wonder, with that sort of evolution, do you see Breakthrough Energy becoming a real go-to leader in climate in the way that the foundation is in global health?
Well, in global health, I wish there were, 10 more foundations, spending, any amount of money picking some of those diseases. You know, the idea of different approaches and more resources, the global health stuff like malaria is one of the most insanely underfunded areas in the world. And, I wish it wasn't so lonely in those areas. Likewise, in climate, it's fantastic that we're getting more people in. I was talking to a lot of philanthropists today about ways that they could give either through Breakthrough or off on their own. I'm talking with Jeff Bezos. We're going to do some things together. He'll obviously do a ton of stuff that's on his own, which, I applaud that. So Breakthrough Energy is an umbrella. The first really big piece was that ventures piece. And part of the reason I'm being so ambitious now about these other pieces is that's gone so well. I mean, literally for the second fund, I didn't have to make a single phone call to raise the fund. Enough people volunteered to join new, and enough people stayed in that we'll be well over $1 billion without, any distraction to me. So my time is spent with that science team, talking through the companies, talking through the policy things that will help enable those companies, what kind of demonstration projects would the companies like to see us drive forward, and figuring out the right partnerships there. That's my primary role. And so that's why we've added Fellows and Catalyst. Catalyst sort of comes out of the fact that as I was going to buy down all of my emissions, like buying green aviation fuel and buying direct air capture through people like Climeworks, there really is no catalytic funding, I became the biggest customer of the biofuel supplier, and I realized, boy, we are going to need a lot more buyers in order to get this thing on the learning curve, like Germany and Japan did for solar energy. And so Catalyst sort of zero was my buying down my emissions, but not just in a brute force way, but in a way that it was advancing technologies whose price can come down very dramatically. And helping governments figure out which of their green hydrogen projects green cement projects really are going to hit a dead end at a certain cost, and which ones really are on the path to being cheap enough to have low green premiums. We have a depth of expertise that, governments in general, don't see all the things going on in the rest of the world. And so you can figure out, so there's some sort of overall plan of all the different efforts there, and bring some money to have a seat at the table and really you know, accelerate those efforts. So, you know, Catalyst is new. We'll get governments and companies on board. Someday we may say to consumers, hey, are you willing to pay hundreds of dollars to something that gets rid of your emissions in this very catalytic way by getting products onto the learning curve? You know, we're not at the point where we're doing that. In the adaptation space, you know, I'd say that innovative seeds are one of the most underfunded things possible. And so we've been telling governments, you know, we want to double the CG seed system, which is about $1 billion a year, up to like $2 billion. So we've been trying to get governments to invest in that. But now we're also thinking, okay, how do we get philanthropists or even individuals who care about the suffering that's being caused to take some of it and go for catalytic buying and some of it to high impact adaptation is an opportunity there. So it's fair to say, you know, we've gotten more ambitious. The sciences piece, which starts with this open source model of the grid, where you can simulate your transmission power sources and then go through the kind of weather conditions that mean that the intermittent sources are largely unavailable, like a big cold front in the Midwest. You know, that open source effort, we started that almost 2 years ago, but we just did our first public release where we can actually do super interesting things because we have so much data about sources and uses that now we're, you know, working with academia and utilities to say, okay, let's, when everybody, somebody says, here's what we need to do on transmission or sources or storage or nuclear, we can try out and say, does it achieve the goals that the electricity sector has to grow dramatically to substitute for direct use of hydrocarbons? It's got to stay reliable, it's got to stay cheap, and it can't be a source of emissions.
Well, I was really interested to read about your efforts working on the grid like that and sort of developing new data tools. And you also referenced in the book how you've done that in global health, too, to kind of get a better understanding of, you know, so much wasn't being measured and so much of this big picture data was lacking. Are there other places in climate where you see that potential for creating new systems of data and understanding?
Yeah, just, you know, if you want to know what your own emissions are, if you want to understand various offsets and how high quality they are, you know, getting data will be quite valuable. Now, it's not the case that just having companies report their emissions is going to get them to zero. You know, a steel company, fine, just multiply. And, you know, cement companies, just multiply. You know, we still need cement. We still need steel. We even still need natural gas and gasoline. People still, you know, want to get to work, and they're not going to overnight abandon their car, nor do we have the capacity to build that many electric cars. But, you know, over time, we can develop that. And so, yes, the whole field is a fairly early stage field in terms of, you know, it feels a bit like global health did in the year 2000, where even really tracking the numbers isn't as easy as it should be, particularly this concept of, okay, what are the hard parts? You know, most articles you read just say, okay, solar panels are cheap, therefore the problem is solved. And that, you know, sadly, is not the case. Even for electricity generation, this the scale-up and the reliability equation will be extremely difficult to achieve despite the miracle of how low-cost wind and solar are. And the U.S. is easier, actually, because of the size of North America. You know, a weather front is about 200 miles wide. So if you're a country like Germany, it's easy to have the whole country shut down. Unless they do it on a European-wide basis, they get no diversity, and so you'd have long periods. Unless you're willing to depend on the region, you'd have long periods where nuclear batteries would be your only source of energy, and that is very difficult to achieve.
Up next, what Bill Gates sees as his own role in the fight against climate change in the years ahead.
Well, you know, it was fun reading the book, too, that it made me stop And remember that I need to think more about nuclear and about biofuels and a few things I've kind of put to the side because of enthusiasm over wind and solar and batteries. And it's like, oh, wait a minute. That's not going to cut it. It's got to be all of these things still. So I wonder, what do you see as your role personally in the climate issue? Is it convincing people of nuclear? Is it pushing lawmakers? Is it investing money? Is, what do you love the most, and what do you see your role as?
Well, I hope this is such an important cause that the percentage that comes from me gets smaller and smaller. I hope that in global health too, but we can make progress in global health without everybody talking about malaria. We cannot make the progress needed in climate without it being a broad discussion in most households in the country. And so you've got to get lots of other people involved. Because of my understanding of innovation ecosystems and my desire to learn lots of science and my access to experts in different areas, I can opine on, okay, is green hydrogen going to be cheap enough? If so, what path would it be? Realistically, I'm not going to make any money on nuclear. I only started it for climate change reasons. And, if I make money, fine, I'll put that into other climate things or global health related things. And so, studying an area for 15 years, you learn quite a bit. You see things that work and don't work. And certainly, I can build a team like the ventures team and the science piece or this grid model piece that governments typically, somehow don't assemble these super grid teams. A few times they do. So you can make a contribution, including that open source grid model. 10 years from now, my role shouldn't be super large. There should be tons of other voices.
Okay. Well, you mentioned earlier that, of course, philanthropy compared to what governments can do the scale is very different. At the same time, with the Giving Pledge, you have a goal of giving away the bulk of your wealth. Yet, since you started the pledge 10 years ago, your worth has gone up significantly. And so I'm wondering when and why or how will you open the floodgates? And maybe right now with climate, maybe there's not places to pour giant sums, or how do you strategize what you do with your resources when you're looking at climate change being a race in many ways and you have the capital? So when does the spending like blow open at some point?
Well, trying to, at the current green premium, that's $5 trillion a year, so all of my money isn't a week of, paying down the green premium. And so, brute force, I'm a rounding error. Most of that money is going towards the U.S. education and global health focus of the foundation. I'm looking more at, the kind of founding money for companies that in this space will be like, Google and Microsoft were in the IT space. You've got Tesla that's now getting a lot of competition, which is a good sign. They've contributed a lot to the one category that we have a clear path to a zero green premium. And there's a lot of, great companies in this. But that's, you can't buy down the units. You can't pay the green premiums. People deserve to have air conditioning and buildings and transport. And so only by multiplying by zero do you actually eliminate categories. There's not a brute force thing. Now, some of the small things that create volume to get technologies on the learning curve, those things really do have a dramatic effect, the so-called catalytic effect. You know, will direct air capture come down in price dramatically? Nobody knows that. And you know, like flying a plane with batteries, well, that battery would have to be 20 times better. It's almost certainly not possible to do that, which is why we either have to make those fuels from some zero emission source, which is biofuels or electric fuels, or we have to come up with some hydrogen-based plan that Breakthrough Energy just funded a company that works in that area, which looks very daunting, but hey, there's some smart people, and they'll team up with the aircraft manufacturers to see what can be done.
Maybe as a last question, I guess one thing I was impressed at your restraint in the book in not going, just spending so much time on innovation, because that's kind of the fun piece, I think, compared to looking at policy and marketplace and that. But of course, again, like you said, all three are essential. But one piece you didn't go very far into is the engineering, the kind of climate engineering and sort of those more out there kind of Hail Mary solutions. Do you have any thoughts there that you didn't really go into in the book, perhaps?
Well, innovation is key, but it's policy innovation. You know, if you can, let's say you can make steel at half the current green premium, that's a zero-sized market. So you'll, you know, who should fund that company? Even though it gets you halfway there, there's no market. The term innovation we have to apply pretty broadly, and we've done that in global health in terms of volume purchasing agreements and ways that we get companies to work together. So it's not just the lab sort of innovation that has that that big impact. Geoengineering, we don't know enough about, you know, what the side effects of that would be. It is interesting, and at the very least, we should understand the problem so that nobody goes and does it unilaterally, because the atmosphere is kind of this important shared resource. In some extreme case, if things got a lot worse quicker than we expect, you might use it to buy yourself 10 or 20 years of the negative effects, but even then, getting the right type of government consensus on whether to do it would be difficult. So getting the people in the lab to figure out some of what works, you know, what we don't understand about global weather effects, I think that is constructive, but it's very small money, nothing compared to what I'm putting into other climate areas.
Yeah, I mean, is there a point where we would reach some sort of a tipping point in 5 years, 10 years, where you have a moment of a feeling like the progress isn't being made that's going to keep us a step ahead of significant disaster, where you would dramatically increase your investment into that?
Well, I certainly wouldn't want to do that alone. I'd want to feel like there was at least some countries and a broad set of scientists and other people. Otherwise, it's kind of like a mad scientist type insanity. I feel like I've done my part to seed that field a little bit. And if others want to come in, fine. I don't see myself going up dramatically. The main negative thing wouldn't be just slow progress, but also some of the positive feedback loops like permafrost methane release or ice melting, we start to see evidence that not only is that the temperature increase causing a linear increase in those things, but it's causing a super linear increase that is going to make the negative effects arrive quicker than we expected. Then I would advise people to at least look into that more seriously. But I'm not going to do anything alone.
Well, it's been fun. Right. I enjoyed the heck out of the book. It really gave me a lot to think about and a framework to think about these issues. So I appreciate your work.
Bill Gates's new book, How to Avoid a Climate Disaster, is due out on Tuesday, February 16th. You can read Lisa Stifler's coverage of the book and watch the video of this interview at geekwire.com/GatesClimate. To see all of GeekWire's coverage of science, tech, business, and more, go to geekwire.com and sign up for our daily email newsletter to catch all of our stories. I'm GeekWire editor Todd Bishop. We will be back this weekend with our weekly news roundup. Until then, thank you for listening to GeekWire.